But we are going to make sure that all of those costs are passed along to the ratepayer. Industrial ratepayers, in particular in Colorado, are unhappy with that. I think the total bill was something over $1 billion, which is significant in a state like Colorado. But those kinds of decisions that in the past had been made primarily based on providing low-cost, affordable power are now made on other environmental or and I would say in some cases more political than environmental. And in that thought, I would like to just, before I give up my 5 minutes, make an observation that I know to be true, but I also know to be controversial. As we look at how energy is produced and distributed and used here in the United States, many people are intensely interested in all of these issues, whether it's distributed generation or renewable power or whatever it may be. But for those of us who care about global climate change, all of that is really irrelevant. And I say that, you know, for I make the obvious point that most of you already know, and that is that the United States percentage of total greenhouse gas emissions is dropping and dropping very quickly as the rest of the world develops, and especially as you have Southeast Asia and now parts of Africa that are trying very hard to provide electricity for people who don't currently have it. And so almost everywhere in the world today, the cheapest way to provide electric power is to burn coal. And that's why we see massive investments in coal in China and India and Southeast Asia. And someone the other day did a calculation based on the IPCC model that said even if we were to shut down every coal-fired power plant in the United States in 2017 and keep them all shuttered through 2050. If you look out at 2050 and you look at what that will do for climate change, the predicted impact using IPCC models is about an impact of about 1/25th of degree in terms of average global temperatures, and in sea level rise it was something even less than that. It was, like, you know, it was a tiny fraction of an inch. And I think the message here, at least for people who, and there are many other reasons to care about power supply. There certainly are localized economic impacts. But when we look at climate change, I think that what we need to be doing is looking at the policies and the funding that are likely to lead through to breakthrough technologies. Because until collectively we figure out a way to produce electric power at a cost that's competitive with coal, we're fighting a losing battle. So I suspect that may provoke some conversation with members at the table, but I look forward to that conversation.
Thank you.
All right. And I won't start that conversation just yet. I have a different kind of focus right now, but that was definitely one brief response that I completely disagree that energy decisions are political. I think there are, particularly throughout different parts of the country where energy costs are higher than maybe that we see on the East Coast, energy decisions are being made more and more from an economic standpoint. And the other thing that I want to point out, just as a response, is he said that the cheapest way to provide power is to burn coal, and there's two really strong reasons that I disagree with that. The first is when we burn coal, there are a lot of costs associated with coal-based generation throughout the life cycle, from the mining to the burning and to the storage of waste, that aren't typically included in the price of electricity. We pay for them in other ways, either through subsidizing coal with tax subsidies and other things, or the public being forced to, for instance, in West Virginia, forced to pay nearly $100 million a year through our own taxes to pay for repairing roads that are damaged by heavy coal trucks, and the coal industry doesn't have to pay for those. So the second one relates more directly to, my own work. I shouldn't have had that coffee before this. And is energy efficiency. Energy efficiency is the cheapest way to provide power. The cheapest way to provide power is to not use it, is to reduce the waste of electricity and heat that we see across the nation, both on the residential side in our homes, but also through our businesses and industrial processes. And that's what we focus on with Appalachian Voices. We recognize that potential, particularly in Appalachia, where there's a lot of many homes that are hugely inefficient. There's a lot of manufactured housing. There's a lot. Energy costs are higher because, let me just get into that. Our program is called Energy Savings for Appalachia. I am the Energy Policy Director, and we're focusing on the cooperative side. So he mentioned co-ops before, and there's three basic types of utilities: large investor-owned utilities, which are like Duke Energy, Progress Energy, Xcel. There's rural electric cooperatives, which are more distributed. They're found in many states. Some states are dominated by cooperatives, and they're publicly owned. The customers own the co-op. Then there's municipal utilities. Like here in Chattanooga, you have a municipal utility that covers electricity and water and other utilities. And our program is trying to help residents across Appalachia, particularly in North Carolina and Tennessee, cover the upfront costs of making their homes more efficient by working with rural electric cooperatives to provide comprehensive, low-cost financing for homes to do whole house retrofits and really save a lot of energy. And this goes back to the discussion of the lowest cost fuel, because energy efficiency is something that, depending on your type of utility, benefits the utility or it doesn't. For instance, with investor-owned utilities, they're profit-driven. They are beholden to their shareholders, and their goal is to increase revenues and increase profits instead of reducing revenues and reducing energy consumption. And so we are focusing on co-ops because they're nonprofit, they're owned by the members. You have a better chance of customers influencing decisions over not only energy efficiency but also distributed generation, distributed renewables, because the customers make the decision. And so that's where kind of ties into the disagreement about things being political, because in Appalachia you see a lot of homeowners who are poor, rural. Like I said, they have very inefficient housing. They don't typically believe that they can influence decisions of the co-op. But so part of our goal is to get out there and educate the residents. And I guess with that, I'm just going to finish by saying I was trying to keep it focused on the topic. I think you brought up a lot of very broad discussion points that I do hope we focus on. But the takeaway point for me is that the type of utility, and this is what I hope drives the discussion, the type of utility, as well as the regulatory structure that's in place, which is diverse across all of the states, largely determines what the generation mix is going to be and what opportunities there are taken advantage of, what possibilities there are in terms of influencing decisions over the type of generation mix and also energy efficiency implementation. So,
okay. Thank you, Willie. John?
Thank you. I'm John Farrell. I'm the Director of Democratic Energy at the Institute for Local Self-Reliance. We're a small outfit based in Minneapolis with an office also in Washington, D.C. In the program or in the notes that I got an email, it said I had 5 to 7 minutes. So I may go a paragraph longer than 5 minutes, but hopefully you'll indulge me. I did write up my remarks because these are journalists in front of me here. I want to make sure I get my facts right. But the title I was extremely intrigued by, about who's your energy daddy, because I think there's a great tie-in that we can make here. For now, who's your energy daddy is essentially utilities, large investor-owned utilities, as we already talked about, rural cooperatives and municipal utilities that are supposedly more focused on their members. But the energy landscape of today also gives me somewhat of an uncomfortable reminder to the Athenian tragedy by Sophocles, the Oedipus tale. So for those who don't recall their college or high school English class, that's the tale of the man who grows up to murder his father, the king, and marry his mother. And in this 21st century version, the utilities are the king, and little Oedipus is represented by solar panels on rooftops, wind turbines, and other ways that utility customers can produce their own energy. I won't speculate on who the mother is. But earlier this year, the Edison Electric Institute, which is what I like to call the daddy's club of the investor-owned utilities, released a report suggesting that Oedipus has in fact grown up and his daddy may not be prepared for the climax of this play. It's summarized into, I think, very poignant headlines from the Clean Energy Press this summer on GRIST, solar panels, quote, could destroy U.S. utilities, and Green Tech Media's very pithy, adapt or die. And the problem is basically that customer power generation from local renewable energy resources reduces utility sales. And I asterisk this because there's, of course, a big debate going on about whether or not that balance sheet view is actually appropriate for calculating whether or not a utility is, in fact, being cost money from customer generation or whether or not they are, in fact, benefiting from many of the unique features of distributed energy. If you want to nerd out on that, I refer you to the Minnesota Value of Solar stakeholder process that's going on right now. You can read more on our website about that, some in plain English and some in the very nerdy fashion. But at any rate, if your utility or state regulatory regime has built its business model around growing energy sales, this creates this customer generation creates what some are calling a utility death spiral, essentially. Falling energy sales force them to raise rates, which further enhances the attractiveness of generating your own energy from solar. And that's why the chair of the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, John Wellinghoff, who unfortunately isn't here today, but he recently said, quote, solar is going to overtake everything, simply because it keeps getting cheaper and utility energy prices are not getting cheaper. So, in other words, Oedipus is a growing threat, and the utility daddy is trying desperately to stave off the storybook conclusion. The problem is that energy daddies grew up in a very different era. In the early days of the electric system, 100 years ago, you needed big capital to build big power plants and big power lines to bring energy to big cities. And the political reality was that we would give these folks monopolies in order to gather that capital to facilitate that infrastructure development, and for decades it worked perfectly. But the problem is that in the next 10 years, electricity from rooftop solar is going to be competitive without subsidies with utility energy prices in almost every state. And I'm talking about retail and not wholesale prices. But basically, I'm a customer. The amount that I pay on my bill is what matters to me. And if I can get cheaper energy from my own rooftop than I can from the utility, I'm going to want to do that. And so you also have then the overlay of renewable energy standards and incentives for distributed renewable energy that illustrate how the public interest and the economic model have really changed the way that the utility system is going to work. And the way that utilities respond to this changing paradigm is really going to be determinative about whether or not this Oedipus tale ends like the play, the Athenian play. For example, in Arizona and Wisconsin and many other states, utilities are trying to gut the basic policies that allow people to generate their own energy. And in some places, they are successful. But I think there's a recent story from Georgia that should give them pause, where a, quote, green tea coalition of environmentalists and Tea Party activists successfully lobbied the Public Utility Commission to force the state's biggest investor-owned utility, Georgia Power, to launch a large distributed solar program, much larger than the utility had initially proposed. So I think the lesson there is that utilities that try to maintain the status quo or to remain the energy daddy, to borrow the title of this, are going to have a very hard time because their customers will fight them for the right to self-generate and to look for their own options for producing energy, especially if it costs them less than utility energy. And these local energy producers are also going to be energy voters. They are going to be in front of the utility commission and lobbying. They are going to be voting in elections about energy, and they are going to care a lot about it if they're being told they can't do something. So I think what we really need to change, what really needs to change in this paradigm, is that we need the utility to transition to becoming more of a facilitator than a ruler, sort of the kindly elder sibling rather than an energy daddy. Because even as utility customers look to their own options for electricity generation, whether it's solar or wind or what have you, they're still going to need a utility network. They're going to need help because they want to use their rooftop solar array to power their electric vehicle. They're going to want to finance high-efficiency appliances and lights and insulation to cut their energy use and their energy bills. And they're going to want to be able to tap into the utility's existing on-demand energy sources like gas or future ones like batteries to keep power delivery smooth and high quality as the grid is transitioning to primarily renewable energy. Unfortunately, this is not going to be easy because utilities, for one, have a lot of money sunk into power plant infrastructure and transmission lines that may or may not, frankly, be useful in this new era. If we generate power on our rooftops, we will not necessarily need to bring a lot of power in on big transmission lines that were built with a 40 and 50 year lifespan and that we may still be paying for in our rates. And for another, the regulatory system doesn't necessarily reward this facilitation role rather than energy sales. I think Rory already alluded to this. If the utility makes its money by selling energy, it's very difficult for it to switch around and act in a different manner. But unfortunately, there's no real alternative because I don't think people are likely to accept, and nor should they, giving up the opportunity to have more control over their energy future.
Okay. Thank you, John. All right. So to get us started a little bit, I think one of the questions, just in case some folks in the audience aren't as familiar, I think most everybody's familiar with a utility and what a membership co-op is, but some people may not be familiar with what distributed generation is. And I think you gave a few little points there, but if you could give me for the audience, a 30-second how my grandmother could understand it description of distributed generation.
I will do my best. The way I like to describe it essentially is that the poles and wires that run through the alley behind your house or bring the power to your house are the low voltage, what the utility calls the distribution system, and if your power generation plugs into those wires and poles as opposed to the big steel towers that are very tall with running very long distances, then you are distributed generation. And another way to think about it is that you are of a scale that is appropriate to the community where you are serving. So you can be built close to where we use energy is another way to look at distributed generation.
Okay. If you have anything you want to add?
Yeah, just to add the other side, that's as opposed to the system that does dominate our electrical grid in the United States. They typically call it centralized generation, where you have one large power plant that serves customers all over the place and sends electricity long distances over transmission and then distribution lines. So distributed generation is more useful for me to think about in terms of a network of small distributed generators compared to the one large centralized power plant.
The only thing that I would add, and by the way, I actually, it is remarkable how far solar has come down in the last decade. It's still not cost competitive with fossil fuels, and various people have predicted, you know, within the next 10 years, it'll be cost competitive. And maybe it will be. I think that would be a good thing for everybody if it is. One of the issues that was alluded to but not really highlighted is the so-called intermittency problem, that at least at this point there's no good storage mechanism. So when your solar panels are not generating electricity at night or on cloudy days, you need to have some sort of a backup. And right now that backup is the utility system. And that's obviously valuable. And there are certain markets now where people get paid just for having standby capacity. I think there are ways that all of that could work. But I come back to my basic point. Virtually everywhere in the world, and energy efficiency is great, and I support all these energy efficiency programs. But you, at least at this point, you still need power somehow to turn on that light bulb and to heat your house. And right now, in almost every part of the world, unless they have really good hydro resources, the cheapest way to provide electricity is to burn coal. And that's why we see dramatic increases in coal throughout the rest of the world. And so I'm supportive of these ideas, and we can talk about, you know, the pros and cons of energy efficiency, and you make a good point about the externalities of burning any fossil fuel. But those are not yet internalized. There's been a lot of discussion about trying to internalize those costs that haven't gone very far. And so I don't think that either of you disagrees with the view that coal-fired generation is the fastest growing source of generation in the world. And in almost everywhere in the world, unless you have access to good hydro, it's the cheapest way to provide electricity. And that's the fundamental problem that I think we all need to deal with.
Mm-hmm. Well, that does bring up an interesting point. A question that I did have on here was, you know, because coal and nuclear have both decreased in the last 3 to 5 years. Oh, I'm sorry, yes. I thought it was. So, here, is that better? I could hear myself very well. Sorry. So coal and nuclear have been on the decline for the last 3 to 5 years.
Only in the U.S.
Yeah. And well, that, yeah.
Yeah. Everywhere else in the world, coal is growing very quickly.
Yeah. Let me rephrase that. In the U.S., coal and nuclear have definitely been on the decline. Natural gas has obviously been on the increase, as well as renewables to a small degree. I think hydro is slightly down a little bit. So looking at this and looking at into the future, I mean, we're talking kind of a little more right now about the U.S. and not the rest of the world, I think, for right now. What role do you think that the fossil fuel and nuclear industries will and should have in the future direction of energy in this country? Who wants to start that?
I'd be happy to jump in. One thing I want to say about the cost of fossil fuels versus the cost of renewables is that it is the utility perspective about that cost. And I think Rory has already talked about, and I think it's somewhat naive of folks in terms of talking about coal power to say, well, since we've never internalized the cost, we don't have to keep it in mind, so we should just keep building coal power plants because they're cheaper to generate electricity. The second one, too, is not recognizing the fact that coal power is in fact, yes, maybe on a levelized cost basis, if you don't talk about any of the costs that it's imposing on society beyond the burning of it, maybe it can deliver you a levelized cost per kilowatt hour that is less than some of the other things that we have available. But on the margin, which is where utilities operate and where they need their energy, which is at peak demand periods for most of the utilities in the United States, coal power is in fact no better than solar, which, although it may be intermittent in the sense that it does not work at night, but it does work during the day, and we fortunately tend to know when the sun rises and the sun sets, we will have it tends to overlap very well with the peak demand periods. So when you look at states like California with high energy prices at the retail level for many different reasons and growing peak demand needs, solar is extremely competitive. I mean, Palo Alto, the municipal utility in Palo Alto, is signing contracts, long-term energy contracts for solar at 7 cents a kilowatt hour. It's going to help meet a quarter of their energy demand for that utility, and it's going to help them meet that marginal demand that's coming from peak energy. And at that, and the fact of the matter is that solar doesn't have to compete with coal in that particular instance. On the other side, you also have wind power, and you know, you have Xcel Energy, for example. I wish they were here. I'm from Minneapolis, which is also served by Xcel, and in many cases, they are signing for new generation long-term contracts for wind rather than for coal because it is cheaper. And granted, we can discuss about
and again, I concede that there are externalities with all these forms of generation, absolutely. But when I talk about costs, I talk about costs that are actually reflected in the marketplace. And if you're looking at the true cost of all of these resources, there are, and by the way, I think there are a lot of benefits to having a diverse supply of electricity. And I'm not a proponent of coal. I'm not a proponent of natural gas. I'm not a proponent of anything. I'm just saying, as a practical matter, the way our system works today, you know, wind is being driven a lot by tax policy and by renewable energy mandates. You wouldn't have anywhere near the kind of wind or solar that we have today if it weren't for subsidies and regulatory mandates.
Same with coal.
Well, there's a big discussion about, and I don't think we should be subsidizing any energy source. But you know, again, the big problem with these renewable resources, last year, what was the, in terms of installed capacity, wind was bigger than any other source of generation in the United States. So we installed in the United States more new wind last year than any other source of energy. But if you look at how much energy was delivered, there was 11 times more energy delivered from gas than from wind. So you have an awful lot of capacity out there that's intermittent, that can't be relied upon, and that's why we put in a lot of capacity, but we still got a lot more power from natural gas than we do from wind without the need for subsidies and without the need for regulatory mandates. And so, you know, all this is very interesting from a U.S. energy perspective, but I keep coming back, when you have places that are concerned about providing the lowest possible cost to their citizens, and you look at China, and you look at India, and you look at Indonesia, and everybody's still building coal. And so until we figure out a way to be cost competitive with coal, there's no way we're going to solve the climate problem. And that's my basic point. I believe we should have solar, I believe we should have wind, we should have all those things, but I just think that we're fooling ourselves if we're not kind of honest about how big the underlying problem is.
Well, what about, so let me ask you this as a follow-up. Do you think there's a place in the future besides staying with those larger models of large-scale utility, whether it be large-scale wind farms or large-scale solar farms, what about the possibility of a place in the future for community-owned?
Are you asking?
Any, yeah. Whoever.
Okay, well, this is a good topic because we're talking about. I wish I could just respond to some things, but we'll move the conversation forward.
I was actually trying to engage in the conversation about what I think the real issues are, because when I talk to people who care about energy efficiency and solar and wind, one of the big concerns is climate change, and so I think we might as well be honest about climate change. So I'd be curious to get your reaction.
About climate change specifically,
about the role. How do we solve the climate change problem?
I think I can answer this while we move into Jamie's question, because I think there's a connection here. But
yeah, we don't want to travel too deep into climate change just because I think there's a couple other panels.
Right, I think, more about this. The focus of this panel is on on our electricity infrastructure and the types of and who's making the decisions. So we'll kind of keep focus on that. But one of those, and this is good, something you said kind of irked me a little bit. You're talking about generation throughout the world, right? They're building coal. They're building those coal plants that don't have strict environmental controls.
Not true. They have scrubbers. They have SCRs in China. They don't have CO2 controls.
But you're talking about, you were talking about all the different countries, right? And so there are demands where you need rapid, large, centralized generators in developing countries or larger countries like China. And that is, for all intents and purposes, if you need a lot of energy fast, then big centralized generators are going to provide you with what you need there. But bringing it back to the United States, the cheapest generation to build in the United States right now is not coal. And sure. I wish we could put all this data up there. You were talking about the levelized cost of energy. Natural gas plants are far cheaper than any of the new coal plants now. We're relying
That's
on
true.
Coal plants that are 30, 40, 50 years old, and they're inefficient. They're expensive to operate. For every ton of coal you put into a coal plant, the embodied energy in that coal, you lose 70% of that by the time it gets to my house, right? Because you're losing it through heat at the power plant, you're losing it through transmission and distribution lines. So that's a huge waste to me. And then our homes and our businesses are wasting energy on the consumption side, on the user side. And so we need a new model, right? And not only do we need a new model, if you want to talk about cost, you're saying that just, on some kind of level playing field that doesn't exist out there, renewables aren't cost competitive with anything in the United States. But if you look at the different things that are happening in the United States to address the cost aspect and to make renewables and distributed generation more accessible to your average customer, your average home, one of the greatest things you all might have heard about Solar Mosaic. It's crowdfunding solar projects, and where I would be able to, from, say, New York, invest in a solar project in California, and I get a return on that. And it's competing, and it's a way to share the cost of this revolution in distributed generation. And unfortunately, some states like North Carolina and Virginia are the large utilities have undue influence over the decisions and over creating access for those types of financing programs and these unique approaches to distributing our generation and making things more sustainable from the electricity side, on the energy side. And I think John has done a lot more in relation, like a lot more research and thought about community owned and community supported renewables. So if you want to add to that.
Well, I think there are two things that are interesting about community ownership. One is simply in terms of talking about the economics of power generation is that it really changes the conversation to one where we are not simply looking at what is the delivered cost for the energy that's coming to my community, but what am I getting out of the energy dollar that I spend? And I think that's the better question. And so if I'm spending a dollar and 99 cents of it are leaving my community to go somewhere else, if I could pay a little bit more for energy, but half my energy dollar stays in my community, multiplies within that local economy, then that's an advantage. Now, that being said, I think it's important to kind of go back to the larger question of who's your energy daddy, in the sense that community energy has been playing on the margins for 10 years, and it continues to play on the margins largely because the markets that we have set up through our regulatory system, which are publicly controlled and owned, don't really allow for that kind of development to happen at any kind of scale. A great example is Xcel Energy just put in Minnesota, their filing for what community solar will look like, and they said, we're going to take 20 megawatts of solar over the next 2 years, and we're going to do it through, a utility-moderated process, which means that it's going to be difficult to put together your application. They have a lot of upfront fees that you have to put through to pay in order to participate in that process. And ultimately, 20 megawatts is just a small fraction when you see that, for example, earlier this spring in April, they were saying that they needed 450 megawatts of new capacity from gas plants to meet peaking needs for the Minnesota market. So, And this actually gets back to a really good point that Jeff brought up earlier about what's going on in Colorado when he's talking about energy policies and about them being sort of economic versus political conversations. Energy policy is only a political conversation. It is only ever a political conversation, and the question about what is economic is really related to the politics. And the frank thing is, as he pointed out, in many states, the Public Utility Commission, the political entity, has basically said that the economics of climate change, the economics of pollution, the economics of health do not matter when it comes to electricity generation, which makes coal and gas very cheap relative to sources that actually cover all of those costs because they don't have that kind of adverse impact. And so I think that, you know, it gets sort of interesting when you talk about, for example, fighting climate change on an international level. I can't set policy in China about how they want to deal with this stuff. And I recognize that if they're not willing to internalize the cost when it comes to coal and other sources of pollution or of other kind of polluting energy generation, there's frankly not much I can do about it. But that doesn't absolve me of the moral imperative to do something about it here and to change our political structure around our energy generation, to use the politics to internalize and make the economics reflective of what the actual cost is to our society. So, you know, like you said, I think you operate in the market as it is established, and what I'm saying is the market as it is established is going to fall apart because customers are going to say, A, we can keep more of our energy dollar in our community if we can generate locally. B, this energy is cleaner than the stuff that we know is having an impact but isn't reflected in the amount we pay for energy. And C, we're going to get out there and vote.
Jeff, would you like to respond to any of that?
And I'm really not just trying to play the pessimist here. Because, as I said before, I think there are real opportunities for distributed generation and for energy efficiency. But the other problem we have, of course, is that residential consumption of energy is an important part, but only a part of the energy that's consumed. And, you know, we've seen this as part of the debate in a number of states, including in California, where there's a recognition that you have heavy industries that are often referred to as energy intensive. And the point that they have made, I think, successfully is if you make the energy that we use too expensive, we can no longer compete in the international marketplace. And therefore, we have no. If energy, as it is in some industries, is over half of the operating costs, then you see people migrating to places where they have very low energy prices. And so, it is certainly true that for you know, and whether you catch them as economic or political reasons, I think there are many people who are willing to pay more for their power. And we already see this throughout different parts of the United States because there is a good that they believe they get from that. But that only covers a portion of the power consumption in the United States. And a big part of that is industrial. And now, we actually are very fortunate in this country that we have low-cost natural gas, which is certainly cleaner and has led to a renaissance in a number of manufacturing industries. But that manufacturing renaissance is not driven by renewable sources and distributed generation. It's really driven by low-cost, highly efficient natural gas plants.
Can I speak to you? You mentioned that the residential sector is only a portion. It is the largest portion of our energy consumption in the United States. But you're right, when it comes down to industrial customers, they are the largest single users of energy. And they're rewarded for it, to be honest. If you look at the rates of electricity in different states, the residential rate is always much higher than the commercial or industrial rate. Industrial customers and businesses pay a lower rate than homeowners do. But I have a good example that kind of, I think, breaks down some of what you're trying to say here. In West Virginia, is a regulated monopoly. It has two dominant large utilities, First Energy and 8, and American Electric Power. And they control energy decisions in electricity generation decisions in West Virginia. There's a couple small co-ops, but they're inconsequential. And West Virginia is also a heavy manufacturing state. It has a history of being a manufacturing state. And unfortunately, those businesses are facing significant challenges in terms of cost of operating their business. And this is in a state that is still 95% coal-based generation. It's a state that actually has started import. It's one of the biggest coal producers in the United States, but its coal is more expensive, so they've had to start importing coal. Central Appalachia has seen the largest increase in the per ton price of coal in the United States, and as a result, we're seeing less demand for that. But there's a company called Century Aluminum, and Century Aluminum wants to install a combined heat and power system in their plant to help their business remain competitive and operational into the future because of these rising costs. And what that means is that they want to capture the waste heat being produced at the plant and then use that at the plant to generate electricity and to use for other heating purposes. And so but those processes typically generate excess electricity at times when they're operating beyond what they need on site. And so they went to, I believe it was AEP, and they said, we would like to put a contract together that to where we can sell you, AEP, the excess electricity. And AEP said, well, we'll only do that if we'll pay you 2.5 cents per kilowatt hour. And this is in a state where, you know, AEP is making two or three times that much per kilowatt hour. And that didn't make it economical for Century Aluminum, even though AEP is benefiting by having free electricity generally. I mean, well, electricity that they would pay for, but they don't have to generate. They don't have to buy the fuel for. So it's cheaper for them or should have been cheaper for them. But because they dominate everything and because they don't want to open that door for allowing others to sell electricity into the grid, they're sacrificing one of the biggest manufacturing companies in West Virginia and that company's future in order to maintain the status quo. So it wasn't economics. Combined heat and power is one of the biggest potential efficiency technologies that could be implemented across all the United States to help our businesses stay open. And in many states, it's being restricted and prevented because of the current utility model in those specific states. So it's... To me, that just kind of belies the whole problem with the system in terms of what potential we could be reaching from efficiency and renewables, and what forces are in place that are preventing those.
So let me. We'll have questions in just a minute. We're almost at the question point. So I'm gonna kind of finish these guys up with this because it was actually going in the direction of one of the questions that I had anyway. So I just kind of let them continue. But you know that does bring up that point. Interesting though, with industry having obviously a certain influence, other industries, and then the power that the coal utility or the electric utilities have. You were mentioning coal at that point. Where does this put the consumer, and as far as residential consumer and even small businesses, and then where do you think they should be in the future, and how would we get to that point? It's a little bit of a multi-part question, but I don't know who wants to start with that one.
Well, yeah. I'm not shy about answering, you know, as you've noticed. This is really complicated stuff. I don't really know anything about about that specific example. I'm a big proponent of combined heat and power. It is an extremely efficient way to because you capture the waste heat. But again, I notice it. You know, it is CHP is always either natural gas or coal. That's just by its nature. But it is a way to get more benefit or biomass. We have a whole bunch of different models in our country. I mean, many, many. We've talked about a few of them. And there is no doubt that there are market failures that need to be addressed. And I think some people have done a pretty good job of addressing or at least thinking about the market failures that lead us to underinvest in energy efficiency. But it's very complicated. At the end of the day, I think you're right, what most consumers care about, and there are some small percentage of consumers who have shown that they're willing to pay more to know that they're getting green power. There are green power programs in a number of states now, but they haven't been all that attractive in terms of getting people to pay more for electricity. Most consumers want to have reliable power at the lowest price they can get it. And notwithstanding that that's the case, we do have actually quite a variety of delivered energy costs in different parts of the country. You look at, you know, California, New England, that tends to have the highest energy prices. You have, again, the areas that tend to be reliant on coal that have the lowest cost electricity. But I think there's a lot of very interesting work out there today as to different ways that you could make all of these markets more competitive. But it is extremely complicated, and some states have had very dramatic failures, such as California back in 2000, where they, you know, deregulated part of the market but didn't regulate other parts. And so I think that, you know, there will be a lot of these little experiments going along, and including in some areas where they're regulated utilities, they are now able to get a return on investment for investments in energy efficiency, which is new. So you actually give regulated utilities an incentive to invest in those things. So there's many, many different models out there, and I'm not sure that there's an easy answer except to say that, you know, by and large, not just industrial consumers, but residential consumers, what they want is reliable power, to know that it's there when they turn on the switch and it's at the lowest possible cost.
John?
Well, I think there's a good example for a few reasons for why, on the one hand, this is a complicated issue, especially the way that we regulate energy in this country in 50 different state markets instead of one big federal policy like they do in other countries. But in other ways, I think it's really simple. We let the large energy companies set energy policy because they tend to control a lot of the utility commissions where they're regulated and establish the way that the market works. And I think a good illustration of how things can change is in Germany, where they have about 25% of their electricity comes from renewable resources under what some could describe as sort of a crash program for renewables, although it really started over 20 years ago. You know, there are a couple things I think are really remarkable about that program. One is that they exempted their big industry from paying any surcharges with regard to the renewable energy. Germany has weathered the world economic crises with more manufacturing intact than the United States has, despite the fact that their electricity rates are twice as high. Another thing that's amazing, too, though, is that the average monthly German electricity bill is exactly the same as it is in the United States because they use less. So when we talk about energy efficiency, for example, and about what the opportunity is there, I think it's worth pointing out that we have not even begun to scratch the surface of what we can do, and that when we talk about delivering reliable and affordable energy to people, affordable is about what I pay every month. It has nothing to do with the rate. So the fact that we buy, you know, it's not about whether or not we buy the cheapest possible kilowatt hour and therefore has to come from some dirty source that we are not paying the full cost of. It's about whether or not I can find a way to lower my energy bill to the maximum extent possible, and is the utility helping me in that? And the answer to that is no, because in the politics of the situation, we have created a market where the utility has every incentive to go out and sell the most energy they can, with a few exceptions, where we are changing that market, where we are solving those market failures. And I think that until we are willing to face up to that and to change the way that that works, we're going to have an extremely difficult time addressing climate change. I focus primarily just on how the U.S. can address its own climate issue rather than internationally. But I think we'll send a signal to other folks around the world if we do it in a way that says we're actually going to look at all of the different pieces of all the different costs. We're going to try to internalize those in the way that makes the most sense. And we're going to do it from a standpoint of providing affordable and reliable power, but we don't have to do it by getting the cheapest possible energy source.
Okay. Thanks, John. Lori, did you want a couple minutes, and then we're going to open it up to questions?
Yeah, definitely. I think John definitely touched on one of the more important aspects in terms of just how the market has been, how the market and how the system has been set up to, in a way that is really restrictive of future change. But I think there's a lot of ways, a lot of things to think about in terms of how to get to where we believe we should be, and to use a term from one of John's reports, democratizing the grid. Right, the grid is, in many respects, a privately owned system, but it's a system that our society depends on. It's a system that we all have a stake in how it's developed and maintained, and so even though we don't own it personally in most cases,
it is however a publicly sanctioned private monopoly.
There you go. But democratizing access to that grid, democratizing, allowing the people, the customers, more choice over how our electricity is generated and how we receive our electricity and what that looks like is one of the more important steps. And it's happening in a lot of ways. You can have state net metering policies that allow me to connect my solar system into the grid. And you have state unique financing systems where communities are allowed to come together and cooperatively finance a solar system that ties into their distribution grid, so it's benefiting their local area. And then providing access. You know, like I said, a lot of states don't have good net metering policies, or they have really restrictive interconnection standards, which is the standards that govern how I am connected into the grid and how that's done in a safe, efficient manner. There's a lot of interconnection standards that are really restrictive. And then rewarding that type of system. Maryland is a great example. They have a state renewable energy portfolio with a specific carve-out requirement for solar, and they're ramping up their annual requirements for how much solar needs to be developed, and it's on the scale of, I think they're going to have 180 megawatts required in a single year in 2015, which is fantastic. And what's that done? It's created a new market, right? You're not socializing the grid. You're creating a new capitalist market for solar that incentivizes and rewards the development of solar, because then you create this renewable energy credit for solar that has a value to it. And that value reflects demand, and it reflects the environmental attributes of those megawatts. And that internalizes the cost, and it levels the playing field, but it's also not a subsidy, right? So it's rewarding that type of system. And a lot of states just don't want to do that.
It is a subsidy. It's a huge subsidy.
A renewable energy credit is not a subsidy.
It's a mandate.
No, it's a value. It's a value attached to the solar. It's a market. It's like sulfur dioxide credits. I mean, would you call those a subsidy, or would you call that
I would call that a regulatory program. And anyway,
it's a credit, just like a renewable energy credit. If it's a subsidy, then it's a subsidy for all.
It's something that the market wouldn't demand if there weren't intervention, and it's something that does increase the cost.
But it creates some anyway.
No, we
can get into that. It creates a market for a new product, for a new commodity.
Okay.
I apologize.
So you have any other last points there?
Anyway, that was my last point.
So
we'll stop there.
So let's go ahead and open up to audience members here. Obviously, SEJ members get priority, but I know the gentleman in the green shirt there. We've had a question a while ago. Yes, and please remember to introduce who you are and who you're affiliated with.
I wanted to follow up something that we're talking about, John, Darrell, in terms of utilities becoming facilitators instead of rulers. And just in one specific point, you mentioned the possibility of the transmission lines might become unnecessary. There are other places like Germany where they're investing in transmission because they see it as a facilitator for renewable energy on larger scales. I want to ask you what you thought about that. And then more broadly on the issue of utilities becoming facilitators, are there any examples of utilities in the U.S. that you see trying to do that, or is it simply impossible today for them to start moving in that direction?
Good questions, both about the transmission sort of life and also about what utilities are providing an example. With regard to transmission, I think the key is not that the two, there's not like a, you know, it's not that transmission and distributed generation are diametrically opposed. There have always been, you know, interconnections in transmission, and they can prove very useful in balancing, you know, the variability of wind across a region or solar across a region. The challenge is that we have been building infrastructure for many years under the assumption that the centralized model of generation is going to continue, that the location of the facilities that we are connecting to the big cities via those transmission lines are fossil fuels, so they're by rail lines, not by, you know, areas of good wind resource or good solar resource. And so the issue of it being stranded is more about, did we build it in the right place? than it is about whether we might need transmission. Although there's an entire issue, frankly, in the way that we regulate energy, where transmission tends to be regulated at the federal level, but the decision about whether or not an alternative to transmission is economic is a state-level decision, and about whether or not the feds are allowed to preempt states and actually requiring utilities to make that kind of calculation. And so there is a very big tension there in the way that we've set up. So again, it's all political. We can change the way that that works, but it's feds versus states. States have lots of, consider themselves to have broader interests, what have you. On the second issue about what utilities are providing good examples, I guess what I would say about it is, if you're talking about investor-owned utilities, the question is what states have created the market the best way to make it happen. And I say that because Xcel Energy, which serves Minneapolis, touts itself as one of the leaders on renewable energy in this country by virtue of serving states that have the most ambitious renewable energy standards. They got started doing wind power because in 1994, the state of Minnesota said, if you're going to keep storing nuclear waste here in the state of Minnesota, we're going to charge you for it. And our bill is 200 megawatts of wind power. And if it's economic, we're going to make you do more. And they did. And they found out, hey, this actually works. But it's not because they just said one day, we're going to do wind power. So it's all about making the regulatory system work for that. And there have been examples, I think, in some of the Northeast states and out in California where they are changing the way that they regulate the energy market to try to take into account some of those things. The other place where the innovation is happening is municipal utilities. You look at Sacramento doing some really remarkable things. I mean, it got kicked off, frankly, back in the late 80s when there was a referendum to close their nuclear facility that was operating at something like a lifetime efficiency of 35%. So it was a terrible boondoggle. They closed it down. They essentially did a crash course in energy efficiency and demand response. They built other, gas plants and things that at that time were economic. They also did a rooftop solar program that was quite remarkable for the sheer fact that they did a bulk purchasing of solar panels for their residential solar installs and got the cost down remarkably low. I read a report that suggested it was $5 a watt installed on residential rooftops in 1999. I don't know what's happened since then, frankly, because that's less than the average today nationwide for a residential rooftop installation. I don't know if it's just because it was a bulk buy or whatnot. I haven't had time to follow up, but it's an example. And municipal utilities, because they're often not regulated at the state level and have the leeway to be driven by local forces, are able to do that. So Austin Energy in Texas, another example of a great leader. They've certified something like 100,000 green buildings in their service territory over the past 20 years, all in excess of the state, building energy code. Again, they did that because it was something that they saw was important locally, and they were able to make that decision because they had the authority.
Okay. The gentleman in the blue, did you still have a question?
I'm not an SEJ member.
Oh, okay. Gotcha. Yes, ma'am.
Yeah, SEJ member. And Kathy Kowalski, freelance reporter. My question goes to a couple of themes that the panel was talking about. On the one hand, we hear about externalities that are not borne by fossil fuel electricity generation and the need to stimulate renewable energy or to make energy efficiency programs like combined heat and power pay. On the other hand, at the same time, you have electric utilities in Ohio, for example, going in and lobbying the legislature to introduce bills that effectively gut a lot of the renewable energy and energy efficiency standards so that then you cannot attract investment. And I guess what I'm looking for is, as a practical matter, how would you go about trying to, stop some of the maneuvering and to actually get a level playing field going?
So you mean stop some of the maneuvering by utilities to get those portfolio standards? Is that?
Right.
Yeah, and just to point out, a lot of states are seeing those challenges happen right now. There's the, what do they call it, ALEC, the American Legislative something, yeah.
Exchange Council.
Exchange Council, thank you. Yeah, and they're obviously funded by large corporate fossil fuel interests, as well as other corporate interests. And so they're going, and we see it in North Carolina. So Appalachian Voices is headquartered in North Carolina. And there was a big push to try to gut North Carolina's renewable portfolio standard, which had, over the course of just a few years, led to thousands of jobs being created just in the solar industry in North Carolina. So Those jobs are at risk, obviously, and the new and the growth that we've seen in North Carolina on from the solar side is at risk. But it's, I mean, that's a hard question. That's an organizing question. You know, it's a question. The answer would be that people need to be more accurately educated on the benefits of renewable energy and the benefits of those policies, and really see what those impacts have been from an economic standpoint, from an environmental standpoint. And just, I mean, I don't know. That's one thing that our organization has tried to do is educate consumers both in Virginia and North Carolina on what the benefits of renewable portfolio standards can be. And a lot of groups are doing that, but it's an uphill challenge. Fortunately, there was a coalition of groups in North Carolina that fought back those efforts last year, but we're probably going to see the same challenge coming up in the following session. So that doesn't have an easy answer, I guess.
Yes, sir.
Two questions piggybacking off the first set of questions.
Please introduce yourself, sorry.
I'm out of Colorado. John, do you have an estimate of how much distributed generation is possible and how much it might vary from across the country, different parts of the country?
Good question. Sorry, for just a quick follow-up to that previous question. If you told any utility that has a publicly sanctioned monopoly that in exchange for your monopoly status you are not allowed to lobby the legislature, that might be one way to go about making a little bit more level playing field, since they have no business having been made the utility that's supposedly in the public interest being there and telling them what to do. Anyway, as far as the distributed generation question, I put out a report in 2009 called Energy Self-Reliant States, in which I charted out how much you can get from distributed renewables, from wind, solar, geothermal, and a couple other sources on a state-by-state basis. It's probably the best baseline analysis of that. Now, I looked at a state level because that's where the political boundaries are, essentially, of your energy regulation. And so some of that is not sort of strictly speaking DG in the sense that, you know, like in Minnesota, a lot of our wind farms are a couple hundred megawatts out in the southwestern portion of the state, not near population centers. But we also did, like, rooftop solar. And it's about 20% of the energy in any given state could come from rooftop solar based on the availability of roof space, for example. With wind power, I mean, the whole western half of the United States could get all of their energy, you know, with an asterisk about storage and variability from renewables within their own borders.
But it really is a cost question. I mean, we could have 100% DG in every city in the United States. It would just be enormously expensive. And so you have to ask the question in terms of cost. And it's really the question with all these things. I mean, I was interested to hear you reference Germany as a success story. I think in many quarters that's viewed as something less than a success because their power prices are twice what they are here, and that has been a big issue for German industry in particular, and for a lot of German pensioners, and that's why you're getting...
The German industry doesn't pay those price increases, and in fact wholesale prices in Germany have been pushed down by the availability of renewables on the system. So they're out there telling people that this is a problem, but they're not even paying for it.
When is the last time a new industrial facility was built in Germany?
I have no idea.
It's been more than a decade now since there's been a big new industrial facility in Germany because of cost about the power prices. So look at all of these things.
When's the last time we had one in the United States? I'm just curious.
They're built all over. They're being built today.
And nothing's been built in Germany.
Not any energy intensive. If you look at like aluminum smelters, iron and steel, they're not building in Germany because the costs are so high. And they're being built here, and they're being built now in the United States. Chemical plants are being shifted from Germany to the United States primarily because of low natural gas prices here. Look at all these things are possible, but it's all a matter of cost. We could all drive electric. We could all drive zero emission vehicles fairly soon, as long as we were willing to give up a lot of the attributes that people are comfortable with. I mean, you can.
Okay.
Please quantify that. What are there good studies from EPRI or from other groups where you could quantify this double for renewable energy?
I can tell you what delivered power prices are in Germany compared to the U.S. Yes, there's good data. Look at that. It turns out to be very difficult because you have to, if you look at the transmission, and I mean, it's enormously difficult. And also,
let's do a good study. Point us to some hard facts that we can look at that EPRI or the industry has done to talk about how difficult or expensive renewable energy is. Because I don't see a lot of that coming back from the industry, frankly. It's just generalities.
Well, there are many, many studies, including DOE studies, including EPRI studies. I don't have them with me, but I think you'd be hard pressed. I mean, even today, the at least for big power, wind is in most places, if you have good wind resources, the most cost competitive with natural gas. But you still have the wind industry saying that we need the production tax credit in order to make us cost competitive with fossil. So I don't think there's any dispute that in most cases renewable resources are more expensive, especially when you consider the need to have backup. I don't think there's any question about that.
Well, actually, if you look in Midwest Energy News, which did an aggregation study of the cost of renewable energy standards, they found essentially no rate impact, or a somewhere between -1% and +1% rate impact from all of the renewable energy standards that have been enacted thus far. Now, we're talking about a different level of renewable energy than 100%, of course, but we're only going to be able to go so fast anyway. So there's a data point there on what we have so far in the United States. The other thing about the cost, and I'm going to come back to this again because I think it is a really good point, are you looking at it from a standpoint of rates, or are you looking at a standpoint of the customer's energy dollar? Rates in Germany are much higher. Customers pay the same amount per month on their bill that they do in the United States. And the other point is in Germany, which I think is very remarkable, half of the renewable energy capacity they have in that country is owned by cooperatives and individuals. So the energy dollar that used to go to Russia for gas or somewhere else for coal, like coal being imported for the United States, as some people have mentioned, is now staying within Germany, and which is why their economy is weathering the economic crises better than the United States. It's one of the reasons, because they have said, we are going to invest here. We understand that the cost per kilowatt hour might be higher, but that the overall value to the German economy is such that we're going to spend that money here. And I think that's why when you look at a state-by-state analysis in the U.S., it's the right way to look at it. A state is a political entity that is concerned about its own economy, and they can look at it from an energy dollar perspective and not just the narrow perspective of rates.
So my second question would be for Jeff from Colorado. Ron Binns and another former UC commissioner, chairman, had been out around the state, around the country, trying to talk with different states about the possibility of reforming regulation of investor-owned utilities so that instead of their profits being determined on how much capacity they have, it goes to the Andrew Levin's idea of that they're making their money on the services delivered. Do you have any thoughts about whether or not we can reform the way we regulate utilities?
I'm going to kind of punt and just say, and I think you know the answer, it turns out to be politically very complicated, right? I mean, we've seen that, it does seem to come and go in waves. There was a while where it looked like most states would move to a competitive model, right? And that led to problems. And again, the result in some states was not politically acceptable, so they've gone back to re-regulation. As John says, there are certainly many frustrating things about our system, but one of the good things about our system is you do have a lot of state experimentation going on, and you have different states with different models and different priorities, and so I think it's going to be very interesting over the next 10 years to see how these different models change. But it's rate regulation and all these companies that have a merchant subsidiary and they're still regulated, and the transmission is regulated differently from the power supply. It's a pretty Byzantine system.
Encourage energy
demonstrate that they encourage efficiency. Is that something that, I mean, from a consumer perspective, that doesn't sound so great, because it's like, well, I'm reducing my use, but I'm not necessarily paying much less. So what's your position on that?
Well, when I'm sitting by myself having a cup of coffee and thinking about how I would design the system, I think to myself, instead of that kind of method, we should be going like this, boom, and blowing it up. Because you're right, it just seems crazy that we are saying, okay, now we're going to pay you for not selling energy where we used to pay you for selling energy. I do play in the real world, however, and I understand that we probably have to make incremental change. And frankly, you know, I think it's reflective in my opening remarks, too, that I think that you do want to take the existing utility, which has a lot of expertise and history in terms of grid operations and things that you still need very badly, even in a distributed renewable energy world. And so you're going to have to figure out how to make that work. Now, I think energy efficiency is sort of one tiny slice. I mean, it's sort of the first bite at the apple. This other states have approached it, like Minnesota, by just saying, you know, here's an energy efficiency standard that you have to meet. You go out and figure out how to meet it. But it's kind of messy, frankly. I mean, I've worked with some people on sort of the implementation process of that and how they track it. You know, the utility actually has to spend some money. Like if I go out and upgrade my house on my own to be energy efficient, they don't get credit for it, so they hate that. But really, we should be working for all of the different ways that that happens. And so, you know, I think ultimately what we are going to need to do if we want to be very successful is to have essentially like a performance standard that says, you know, your goal, Xcel Energy in Minnesota, for example, is to be reduce carbon emissions by 80% by 2050, and if we want to make specificity about nuclear energy and renewables and whatever, that we do that, we make a performance standard, and we say, you know, we want this portion of it to be customer-owned if that's what we care about. We want, you know, you to reduce energy sales by X amount per year, and as long as you're on target to meet those goals, we'll give you the same rate of return or whatever on the money that you invest in doing that that we did before. That, to me, is about the only way that you can approach it. And in fact, I think it's in some ways almost easier with the investor-owned utilities, despite the politics of it, where they have the money to lobby to stop you from doing anything. It might actually be easier for them because you can throw money at them to get them to agree to do what you want. As long as their shareholders are held harmless, they're fine with whatever you want to come up with. But the cooperatives and the muni utilities are often providing a revenue stream to the general fund of the city. And they still have the same kind of institutional inertia that the investor-owned utility does. And yet they also but they don't have that profit motive that you can hook into. And so figuring out how to do that is a little bit more tricky. Fortunately, places like Chattanooga are actually a really good example. They built the smart grid here without any intention of getting any outside money. They happened to get a federal grant that accelerated the rollout of it. It's saving them money on disaster recovery, like $1.5 million in one storm in the middle of last summer. They estimate something like $500 million over 10 years in terms of reliability and resilience in the grid system. When you talk about climate change adaptation, for example, that's a big thing. I don't even know that they have explored the full potential that they have for that system to do things like energy efficiency. They're doing demand response and whatever. But I think, you know, that's an example of how they can do it. It's just there's not a lot of municipal utilities that are thinking about it that way, frankly. And so that's going to be, I think, the bigger question.
There's actually Tennessee has some good examples of public utilities, at least, that, like, I love how you said that, you know, we typically pay utilities to sell electricity. Now we want to pay them not to sell electricity. I think that's completely ridiculous, especially since most energy efficiency measures, such as whether you're looking at commercial or industrial, demand-side management or CHP or something, or even residential energy efficiency measures, typically provide a net return for the utility because it reduces future costs. Like if you did an expansive energy efficiency program that had a big impact, it would eliminate or alleviate the need for future transmission or distribution, other capital costs that we'd end up paying anyway. And utilities know that. And there's also, he mentioned earlier that during peak times, the cost for utilities is higher. It's a lot more costly for them to manage the grid, to ensure a sufficient power supply to meet those peak demands. And if you shave that through energy efficiency measures, it reduces their cost too. And there's one utility, like I said, we work with co-ops, and there was one co-op that I met with in North Carolina that showed me the results of analysis of different residential energy efficiency improvements, such as switching baseboard electric heaters to heat pumps, or insulating homes or repairing leaky ducts or stuff like that. And then they had an index for what was it a net cost or benefit to the consumer and also for the co-op. And 90% of those items was a net benefit for the co-op. So it reduced their costs beyond what they would pay to help the customer implement those. And so across the board, you're going to see that. So I think it's actually, all in all, kind of ludicrous that any state would consider paying a utility for energy efficiency. And I think that's more of a problem with investor-owned utilities just because they are profit-driven. But co-ops and munis are nonprofit, and they are more amenable to being influenced by their members because with co-ops, I'm a co-op member, and that makes me part owner of the utility, so I have a say. So I think there's obviously unique challenges, but there's also unique ways to overcome that. Like what the model we're promoting is a low cost financing loan for residential customers who don't have access to the capital to make their homes more energy efficient, and the co-op will provide those loans. And the way the program structure is that it's a net savings for the resident. So what they're saving based on because of those energy efficiency improvements is greater than what they're paying back on an annual basis on the loan back to the utility. And so there's ways that we can do it to where it's a net benefit for everybody, and it's easy to put in place. So
we're running over here a bit. So if we could probably take one more very short question. If we have a gentleman in blue, please.
So my name is William Mark Matthew with cleantexica.com. So Jeff, you said earlier that you were talking about coal and costs. You said you weren't an advocate for coal and natural gas, but your firm represents coal and natural gas companies. So doesn't that literally make you an advocate for coal and natural gas?
My firm represents companies that generate wind, that do solar projects. My firm does all kinds of energy. It is certainly true that many of our biggest clients have coal and natural gas. And so if you choose to view me as an advocate for coal and natural gas, that's fine. I just hope that you'll think about the things that I've actually said. I always find these arguments a little amusing. I mean, we all have our different perspectives here. And I think my colleagues have made some very good points. So the fact that they're advocates for a particular point of view, I don't think takes away from any of the points that they've made. And I hope you would take what I've said in the same vein. I mean, this isn't probably the time, but I do think there are things that we ought to be doing to deal with climate change. And I've long been a big proponent of ways to incentivize breakthrough technologies because I really do think that is the only way we're going to deal with it ultimately. And there's some very interesting work about government policies and programs that have proven to be effective in that space. But anyway, yes, I represent companies that mine coal, that burn coal, that burn natural gas, that have wind farms and solar arrays and other things. So we do all kinds of energy work in my law firm.
Okay. All right. Well, I really want to thank Jeff, Rory, and John for agreeing to come to see us. So I think we're actually over. You might need
to. I just want to say thank you.
Yes.
Because it's so rare to be able to get utility spokesmen to come. It's nice to have somebody from Graceville, Giuliani, to actually express these points of view.
Yeah.
Well, thank you.
Thank you, everybody. Thank you, the panelists, for coming. Thank you all for coming.
Thanks for coming.